Hi, this is Mike G, and welcome again. We are in the midst of preparing for a dynamic inquiry intensive where we're going to actually spend the time in actual role play and debriefs, asking those of you who have not yet joined us to catch up with the recorded audio and video that's already available to define the six skills. Basically, the six skills are real simple: ping, probe, prompt, permit, perturb, and pause. And what we're doing in the program is trying to get you from a non-discreet level zero, a basic, I didn't hear about this stuff before, to where you can differentiate the six skills and then begin to practice them. So our hope is to get you moved from zero to level one. And then those that are taking this program again for the second time as an intensive, we're hoping to get you from level one, I know what those are, to level two. Oh, I can start to use them and I know what I could do or could have done by using and weaving in different skills. The idea of getting you to level two would be that it would begin to promote your own self-development because of the conversation that you have going on inside your head at the same time while you're trying to listen to evoke meaning-making from the other person in the dynamic inquiry process. This leads me to talk about something that I've been giving a lot of thought to. Basically, for those of you who know me personally, I did a virtual developmental plan for an executive CEO back, I'm thinking it was probably 10 or 15 years ago. And I chose empathy for the developmental low-hanging fruit. That has been in the back of my mind for as long as I can remember because my type is not motivated to access the normal social cues that a person with natural empathy automatically has access to. It's easy to tell. Those of you who have taken the Reese profile, the acceptance continuum, low acceptance sort of, how would you say it, provides a barrier to social cues because the self-confidence and the narcissism, when it's unhealthy, arises from listening to yourself, not doubting yourself, having no doubt in yourself. Whereas on the other end of the continuum, which you would see as like ultimate self-doubt, those that are naturally, how would you say it, vulnerable to depression because of the self-doubt motivation, actually are super sensitive to social cues. And therefore, they almost become like other people, which is why they're so vulnerable to depression. So all of us are probably somewhere in between those extremes. I happen to be at one extreme on the other end, and no, I'm never depressed, and probably narcissistic, and all of those things that you would ascribe to someone with that affliction. So empathy for me was a good thing. Well, in looking at what organizations and our culture is beginning to do with empathy, there is a constant dialogue at the CEO level where we don't always find a lot of natural empathy. I will admit there are some CEOs that I have run into and some that have been written about that have a wonderful gift of seemingly being able to have natural empathy and at the same time make the tough decisions that not having natural empathy would give them. Empathy is being talked about a lot. And one of the things that I have been giving some thought to after codifying dynamic inquiry over the past decade or so is if we could build a system that would naturally produce empathy as a result of the system. Because if you look at empathy, empathy really comes from social awareness. If you go back to the emotional intelligence research and the idea of picking up social cues, knowing what it's like to feel like another person, being able to take perspectives from their side, stand in their shoes, those kinds of things like that, are much more biological than they are nurtured. Most people will claim that it's nurturing, that you can develop empathy very easy and all that, but not if you don't get social cues. If you're oblivious to social cues because you're constantly in a self-confident mode, then you will miss the cues, the support, and the scaffolding you need to be naturally empathetic. As I've developed dynamic inquiry, one of the attempts, at least in my own evolution as a coach over the last three decades, was to how can I try to understand how another person is so I can differentiate that from where they are. In other words, there are several realms that as a service person in service or helping or as I would say, coaching in more professional terms, that you need to be able to separate the person's emotional environment from their level of capability in both managing that environment and holding it as object. What I've tried to do is approach this from the thinking, the logical side of the MBTI dichotomy on T and F, rather from the natural side where empathy comes, because for 15 years I've been working on empathy. Well, it's just not easy when you don't have social cues. It's just not easy when you don't have emotional support for taking in those cues and feeling like other people, as well as the scaffolding that you need biologically to naturally be empathetic. Some people are just naturally empathetic. The rest of us have to work really hard at trying not to piss other people off, I guess you might say, in its most unhealthy form. And so having a lot of experience with that and a lot of successful failures, one of the things that I have been doing with dynamic inquiry is trying to weave into it a way in which to teach the logical thinking brain the rationale for emergent empathy. This is something that I've wanted to talk about for some time because I believe that dynamic inquiry, through the use of the skills, produces an emergent form of empathy, which if I would ask you to just stop and think for a minute, what do you think empathy means? What do you think empathy looks like when you see it? If you look at dynamic inquiry and the six skills, the things that we're doing there are going to produce, if not an authentic form of empathy as people would have it from a natural side, certainly a good synthetic form of emergent empathy that makes a lot of sense, because we're trying to change how you listen. We're trying to change what you pay attention to. We're trying to evoke meaning from the person we're interacting with so that they reveal their meaning-making system. Well, when you start to tabulate all of the different things that we're trying to do with dynamic inquiry, a lot of those are going to also fit in the column of demonstrating empathy. For me, this is really a lot of bang for the buck from a personal standpoint to develop more skill with density and frequency. And what I mean by that is different ways of getting there. I used to think about my time in Moscow before I really had an education in Manila about traffic. And you know, Moscow, like a lot of cities, is developed in rings. The city was started in around 800, I think. And so as the city grew, it grew in rings. They added rings to it. And now I think there's like 5, 6, maybe 7 rings surrounding Moscow. And it was really built for about 3 million people. And there are probably 10 to 15 million people there if they could count everybody. And so when we used to drive around Moscow, if you were with a good driver, and you never want to drive in Moscow, you always want a driver because there's so many places to get lost and everything's in Russian. So unless you speak Russian, you're going to get lost really fast. The good drivers would do is they would know all the nooks and crannies and side streets, because you got to remember that Moscow was built like a European city. And so it had very narrow, the inner city has very narrow streets, much like London or some of the older cities in Europe. And so they would know all these nooks and crannies and back alleys and stuff like that. They would know if traffic was going here, they would go this way. And that's my easiest way to explain density to you. In other words, if you look at optimal functioning in the brain under high support conditions, you will see the involvement of many more synapses and neurons than you would with low density, low support environments. And this is one of the things that we'll talk about later on as we get deeper into trying to understand what's really going on in the head of another person in terms of this process we call IMOL, which stands for importance, motivation, urgency, leverage, and low-hanging fruit. Now, I've spoken about it and I'll speak about it some more. The idea is that as we begin to reveal meaning make, there are many different ways to do it. So just like the driver who knows all the nooks and crannies, a way to get around Moscow, we begin to build density with the six skills and be able to combine them, be able to use them in different ways that are very efficient, effective, and also sustainable so that meaning making flows cleanly from the person that we're interacting with, which then gives us the best read on where the person is and what's next for them. I mean, the underlying reason for dynamic inquiry is, where is the person now and what's next? And how do we cue, support, and scaffold that? So if you're a leader developing people or mentoring people, if you're a manager with subordinates, or you're a doctor or a lawyer or a customer service representative, you want to understand where people are and then what's next. It doesn't do any good for you to provide a solution that's not within their ability to assimilate it to the problem they have. So we are constantly, every one of us, every bit of the day, judging where people are and where we are in relation to that and trying to offer them advice. Those of you who have been around me a while know that I'm very fond of Chris Argyris and Flawed Advice in the Management Trap, where he actually takes apart Covey in his examples as to why people don't use the seven habits. And the reason that they don't, because it doesn't work for them, because it's not actionable. It's not in an actionable format. In order for us to cue, support, and scaffold what's next, we have to put it in an actionable format. And that requires knowing where they are and knowing what's next for them, what they have the ability to assimilate. It's not just a matter of solving their problem, which in the first part of my coaching, I thought that what we would do is just solve people's problem, because some of us need to be problem solvers. It makes a great occasion. You get paid for doing what you love to do. Only thing is, it doesn't work very well, which is what Argyris pointed out in the book and his research. So the thing that I was wanting to create through this process, because we know that meaning making flows much cleaner when the person is engaged, when things are important, they are motivated, things are urgent, there is leverage and low-hanging fruit available. The idea would be, is how could we produce what appears to be an empathetic framework through the use of these skills? And logically, I can make a case for that. And that's the point of today's session for those of you who are thinking about, well, how would I use this system? How would I do dynamic inquiry in a way that would benefit not only me, but the people that I'm interacting with? I mean, it benefits us as leaders, managers, doctors, lawyers, for us to know where people are so that we can give them good advice, good solution. We can help them, guide them, develop them, mentor them, those kinds of things like that. Get their problem solved as a customer service representative, or help them if we're in the helping fields. Again, these are important things. The key would be in the process to not only show how to go around the wheel both ways. If you refer back to the matrix, that you can draw a square on your page and draw a cross in the square. You create four boxes. In the top left, put self-awareness. In the top right, put social awareness. In the bottom left, put self-management. In the bottom right, put relationship management. Okay, so that's self-awareness, social awareness, self-management, relationship management. Well, normally what happens is that we choose, because of our bias, to go around the wheel in a different way, clockwise or counterclockwise. Counterclockwise people manage themselves to manage relationships. Clockwise people manage others, are aware of others to manage relationships. By using dynamic inquiry, we can actually go around the horn both ways. And the key is, even though those of us who self-manage to manage relationships can't pick up social cues, we can produce the conditions where the cues emerge. Even though naturally we're not attuned to that, we can learn through the process of using dynamic inquiry to allow that to emerge. For me, there's a tremendous amount of benefit, and I wanted to talk about that, because a lot of logical people are going to, in my view, benefit from using an approach like this, because it has a spin-off of helping the other person think or feel you're being empathetic. Because the way you change your listening, because you hear them, because you're present, because you are starting with beginner's mind rather than knowing or jumping to conclusions right away. This model teaches that through the six skills. So the idea that I have about this being a skill set that every person should learn, aside from the fact that it would help not only society, but help everybody in the process of being more happy. The idea would be is that you learn to weave these skills, and you don't use them all the time. In other words, it's like in coaching. When I'm doing a coaching session with a CEO or a manager or even somebody in their private life, we're not coaching much of the time. We're interacting. There are moments that provide openings and opportunities and possibilities and plans and outcomes and right action for coaching. Most of the time, that is all wrapped up in a lot of other stuff that you do during the quote-unquote process we call coaching. So what I have done is to try to lift out those coachable moments, those openings, and then let's work in there as if we have one and then practice these skills. That's how we'll put together these brief role plays. Basically, we can spend about 30 or 40 minutes debriefing a 1 minute role play, especially in the early stages where there are a lot of teachable points of view available for each thing that everybody says. You have to understand that each word or what you would call a node is part of a network. So when you speak a word or you speak a sentence, each word or word group is a node, and those nodes all interact with other nodes to promote meaning. So you can create an extremely large amount of complexity in a very short period of time with which to deconstruct what it might mean. And of course, that's what we want to teach you to do in the meta process, because as you listen for where they are and what's next and what might be appropriate for you to do, be, have, become, and contribute, these things will reveal themselves as people reveal their meaning making. What dynamic inquiry is designed to do is to use these openings, these coachable moments, and then inside that, evoke higher quality of meaning making that is as clean as possible from our engagement. Now, obviously, when two people are together, you have joint meaning making going on. That's the idea behind conversations and interactions and all other sorts of things we do in life. At the same time, if we're in a quote-unquote helping function, we are looking at how to cue, support, and scaffold what's next for the person, whether it be a doctor, a lawyer, a manager, a leader, a customer service representative, a priest, a pastor, a rabbi. It doesn't really matter. We're still in that function, so we have to understand, based on what we know about giving advice, based on what we know about deciding what's next, and where people are in terms of that level, what we need to listen for and what we need to do. So how do we do that? That's dynamic inquiry. The idea of understanding how to use a ping, what a ping is, what's the difference between a ping and a probe, what is a prompt. Most of us use those very easily, but there's reasons to use them much more sparingly than we do and to resist taking the transactional lead. There's all sorts of things that we can learn about those six skills. And of course, pause is so important, because most of us are uncomfortable with it. These six skills that we're going to practice in the intensive that's coming up, you don't need a lot of content to get involved very quickly in understanding and using the six skills. Now, density and frequency obviously occurs the more you use them and the different ways in which you use them, combine them, weave them together. And that will come with practice, as any practice does. And then the last thing that I wanted to say is that I believe that dynamic inquiry is a wonderful meditative practice. It is a meditation where you're with someone and not in silence. You are watching your own thoughts as they go by. And the observer in that case is still an important position to understand, as we would have in silent meditation, the ability for us not to become attached to our thoughts, but to see the array of thoughts that are being produced in the interaction and to come back to center, to breathe, and to be present while the other person is revealing their meaning making. So for me, there are a lot of reasons to learn dynamic inquiry. There's a lot of reasons to learn to get good at it. And it is a very, in my view, wholesome practice, because it actually works on us. And that's why it comes from the Coach 2 principles. The idea that I had between Coach 2 or using Coach 2 was that when you're coaching someone, you're also in coaching yourself. So there's two people being coached in a coaching interaction, and that's you and that's the person that is actually receiving the coaching. So those are things that are important to put together in terms of how we look at dynamic inquiry, the idea that we can produce, at least synthesize an empathetic environment. There's benefits to that in terms of revealing meaning making. There's benefits in terms of learning the meditative practice of watching your thoughts, not being attached to them, not being attached to your own conversation while you're present to another person. It actually gives you an opportunity to practice that every time you interact with another person once you begin to understand the process and what's going on. And then to choose those small snippets of the interaction that there is an opening that emerges for us to deploy dynamic inquiry or to go into dialogue or to be in dialogue with others. So I'm going to stop there. I think I presented what I wanted to present for today. I just want to tell you that we have an intensive coming up in coming year. What we'll do specifically is we'll take the sessions. In the first session, I will do a brief introduction and a get everybody up to speed, quick overview of the six skills. Then we will have a short role play to end the program. The programs will not be long. They will try to keep them less than 60 minutes with questions, but my preference would be for them to run about 40 minutes, 45 minutes. The way that we'll set them up is that the role play that we do at the end of the previous session will be transcribed and recorded. And that is made available then for us to debrief in the next session. We'll spend our time debriefing that role play and again, interacting with the six skills. And then we'll create another role play for the next session. We'll do five classes. We'll do four role plays, debriefs after the first class. And the class will run Monday through Friday. And I believe Gary's got it scheduled in the evenings. We'll get back to you on the exact time. Just be sure you're on a mailing list if you're listening to this. If not, Gary, you need to make sure that when you mail this out that they can get on that mailing list so that they can at least track us through the year as we hold these intensives. And what I found is, and gotten feedback on, is that people learn a lot by being engaged in the debrief. So in other words, having the actual words there, having the actual responses, seeing what people say, those kinds of things are actually the easiest way to learn how to do this system. And then, of course, the role play itself. I mean, you can't learn this system except through viscerally learning it. I mean, you literally have to go through it. At the same time, as we set you up to go from 0 to 1 and 1 to 2, you don't have to spend so much time under the gun. You can take in a lot of information and get a long way down the road with just hearing the role play itself being debriefed and seeing the types of inquiry that are used for each of the six skills. And of course, that's a learning process that you can begin to learn, take notes on, and things like that. So that when you do get in practice, which will come later, where we try to move you up the ladder a little bit in terms of your density and frequency and the use of the skills, and you're getting personalized feedback, that's going to be helpful to you to have that base. So for those of you that haven't had the opportunity to join us before, there's really no requirement. There's not a prerequisite to this program. We will make available, though, the PowerPoint slides, which are short, and some of the background material is available as well for those of you that want to deepen your information about it before we get into the actual debriefing process. The one thing I have to apologize for before we even get started is the fact that we do use a lot of jargon. I try to explain most of it, but it comes from 30 years of doing this stuff. And if you just walk into a military briefing or a government briefing or sat in someone's software development meeting, you would hear a lot of jargon as well. And we have developed a lot of our own jargon in this developmental world of coaching that we're in. And consequently, I'll have to try to explain that. Or Gary, we actually created a page at one point in time, a glossary of our jargon and acronyms and things like that. We should probably try to make that available or find it and make that as an attachment to this class so people can just come and go as they want without having to have so much of the background. So what we can do now is I'm open to take some questions.
I have a question between about the difference between ping and probe.
Right. Well, they both use same language. They mostly start with things like is, was, could, have, has, do, does, those types of should. I mean, any of those types of things are usually ping and probe language. The difference between a ping and a probe is a ping is something that you feel exists but has not been proven to exist yet. It could be an assumption that you don't know about. It could be something that you feel is hidden. It could be something in your intuition you want to test, but it has not been tabled yet, as the Canadians say. It has not been put into the conversation. So if you're using the ping probe language and you're testing an assumption, then it would sound the same as a probe, but a probe, the difference between a probe and the reason I made them different is a probe is for something that is already in existence, that we know to be in existence. So we're going to probe it. A ping is like sonar to see if something is out there. If a lot of times we'll get intuitive flashes about, oh, I wonder if that's the case, or is that going on? Especially when you're listening for developmental level, because we have been taught in our society, and I think generally speaking, this is probably where human language works because of its vicarious nature and its monkey see, monkey do, and mirror neurons and all that jazz, is to say things that other people say. And we don't necessarily understand them sometimes, especially in the early stages. If someone is talking about something and you feel that there might be something else out there, but they haven't said it yet, well, then when you use that ping probe language, it's probably going to be, unless you use the term that they used, a ping, because you're checking to see if something's out there. Do they really understand it? Do they really know it like you? They sound like they know it. There's a lot of things that we can do to ping. For instance, when someone's talking about resistance or apprehension or anxiety, there might be fear there. We can ping that. Are you afraid? Is there something you're afraid of? I mean, there's all kinds of things. So hopefully that helps you. Ping, sonar, probe, something's already on the table. And in fact, in a probe, you almost always use their word. For instance, if someone says, I'm really nervous about getting this job, and you say, nervous? That'd be a probe. Does that make sense? Pings are extremely important for developmentalists, people who want to understand where people really are and how much density and frequency is there. Because you don't, just because someone says something doesn't mean they know it or understand it or could explain it or teach it at that level. Those are all different levels. So the ping is very helpful for us. The ping for me has been very important because I am, my convincer pattern in NLP is automatic, which means I need a small amount of data to make a judgment. Now, that doesn't mean it's a right judgment, because you got to understand there's a book written, I think his name was Myers, if I remember right, on intuition. And he basically, his research showed that intuition is right about half the time. So those of us who are pingers, those of us jump to conclusions real quick, usually can use our intuition to do a lot of pinging. And pinging is actually pretty empathetic, except when a ping is combined with a perturb. Some of us are very good at that, and we can actually bite people pretty good with a ping. So we want to watch that. Generally speaking, pings are extremely helpful to developmentalists because they actually help us understand, okay, the person seems that they're at this level, but where are they in that level? Have they just come to that level? Are they nodal? In other words, are they fairly sophisticated, or are they just beginning to go to the next level and we're starting to see some other stuff, so that other level is kind of trailing still? So there's lots of things that can help us. I'll go back to Dr. Claire Graves. I was listening to him speak one time. I never saw him live, but I have heard him on audio. And his research showed that once we got more than a half level of development away from people, they could not assimilate. So we need to be within a half level. And the same thing comes from Ardris, not in the same language, is that in order for us to give advice that's actionable, it has to be testable and the cause and effect have to be known to the person using it. You can't just say, oh, try this and it works, because the person may or may not try that with enough whatever, or to do it a certain way, and it won't work for them, so it's not actionable. So the thing is, we need to be pretty close to people when we're queuing, supporting, and scaffolding them in order to help them get their problem solved, or to help them understand that their problem can't be solved at the level that they're at, and therefore reach out and get some help, be more resilient, work on anti-fragility, those kind of big words. That's the reason that I think that Ping deserves a real seat at the table. It also, Ping is related to a lot of the meta work. In other words, the work about the work. And I think a lot of times when you're working with individuals who are showing high potential, pings are a good way to find out what that range is without actually, quote unquote, disturbing the force so much. A ping is almost always an indirect way of finding something out. It's not the more direct probing, and it's not as direct as prompting, which we'll talk more about. Hopefully that helps you a little. All right, good. Thanks for the question. Okay, like I said, if you have questions, email us, let us know. If you want to join the intensive, there's a way to do that. The first one, Gary, we're not making the intensive very expensive, are we?
No, Mike, I believe we're keeping it at $250.
Okay, so the next one will be at the license fee. Basically, what you get with this work is a personal license to use this stuff. It's actually proprietary material, and so we don't want people teaching it or using it without permission. So you get a personal license to use this stuff. If you want to talk to us about teaching it in your organization or using it or commercially using it in another language or something like that, be sure to talk to us. We'll help you get that done. Thanks, Gary. Thanks, everyone. Thanks for attending.